Hello, everybody. I'm Dwayne Mancini, and welcome to another episode of the Project MedTech Podcast. If you need anything from us or would like to suggest a future guest, you can email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. For more information on Project MedTech, our events we host, our consulting and advisory services, and to sign up for our monthly newsletter, visit our website, www.projectmedtech.com, and follow us on LinkedIn. If you're enjoying this content, don't forget to check out our other podcasts by searching Funding MedTech on your favorite podcast platform or heading to our website. Funding MedTech is our newest podcast that is a spinoff of our MedTech Money podcast series. There won't be any new podcast episodes of MedTech Money, but I encourage you to check out those old episodes as there is some awesome content on raising and investing capital. Funding MedTech is an interview-style podcast focused on exploring ways to fund MedTech innovation and will be released weekly on Wednesdays. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Sleeman and Lund LLP. Sleeman and Lund LLP is a leading intellectual property boutique specializing in medical devices. They've become a trusted partner for investors, startups, and industry giants alike. Founded by seasoned attorneys with decades of experience, Sleeman and Lund combines experience with innovation. When it comes to protecting your groundbreaking medical device inventions, Sleeman and Lund stands at the forefront, offering expert legal counsel and strategic guidance that can make all the difference. Whether you're a passionate inventor with a game-changing idea or a company seeking to safeguard your innovations, Sleeman and Lund has the expertise and experience you need to navigate the complex world of medical device patents. In this episode, Scott Feiler at ProMedics and I discuss his background as a Green Beret, the problem with diagnosing sepsis, what he has learned in his entrepreneurial journey, and so much more. So without further ado, my discussion with Scott Feiler.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future and what comes next with Project MedTech.
Yeah. So Scott,
hey,
let's
Dwayne.
Start with a introduction into who you are and what you do. And actually, before I do that, I suppose I should talk about why we're chatting today. So as part of the 2023 Midwest Showcase here in Cleveland, Ohio, that we just put on in August, we gave away podcasts, interviews to the top three finalists in our pitch competition. So there were 40 startup companies that applied, 10 were chosen to pitch, and then there were three companies who, I guess there was one third place, 2 seconds, and a first place, and Scott was the winner of the pitch competition. And so part of this was a podcast interview. So with that, Scott, introduction into you, your background in med tech, and what you're currently doing.
Yeah, so thanks, Dwayne. And by the way, we were really excited to pitch Project MedTech. And thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to do so. And obviously, we're excited that we won. That's the best part, you know, that's the icing. But getting to meet the team at Project MedTech and everybody in Cleveland, it was a great experience. It was really, really good.
We appreciate that. Yeah, we appreciate that.
So I'm Scott Feiler. I'm CEO of ProMedics. We are a medical device startup company that has a wearable, non-invasive fingertip sensor for monitoring peripheral blood flow. And we can get into that a little bit more later in the podcast. But my background, so, you know, I have a son who's at St. Louis University now studying mathematics. And I alerted him that I think it's cool that he wants to be an actuary, but he should be emotionally and intellectually prepared to never use his undergraduate degree after college because it goes without saying. I say that, but that sort of tongue in cheek in part because I have on occasion used my undergraduate. So I studied molecular biology at Benedictine University and biomedical ethics. I ended up having a position right away as a staff scientist at Argonne National Laboratory immediately after graduating from undergrad. Part of that was facilitated by the fact that I had spent 6 years in U.S. Army Special Forces. I know anyone looking at this podcast, I've got a face for radio, but my body is a clear indication that that there's no way you could align the fact that I was in U.S. Army Special Forces as a medic. that was greater than 30 years ago. And a lot changes, you know. I can tell you what happens at age 40 and then at age 50 metabolically, and it's ugly. It's an ugly thing. But at any rate, I'll get back on the Peloton, I swear to God. But so I was a Green Beret for 6 years, and I happened to stumble into a program. I had received an NSF grant while an undergrad that allowed me to work at Argonne, and then when I graduated, they immediately hired me. And it was actually in national security. So I did a lot of, with the biology degree, the molecular biology degree, I worked a lot with programs that had to do with immunoassays, multiplexed immunoassays, structural biology, principally in the area of peptide nucleic acids. So I got sort of my cut my teeth, if you will, in the National Laboratory Department of Energy space in bench to bedside innovation, and working quite a bit with tech transfer. Fast forward after almost a decade doing that, and I started working in healthcare, specifically in healthcare strategy. And I received a master's in public health from Johns Hopkins, and then later an MBA from Notre Dame University, Mendoza College of Business. And stuck kind of in the lane of med tech strategy for a good period of time, until a number of my fellow classmates from Mendoza School of Business decided to open up a consultancy to support innovative technologies that stem from universities, and helping them go from idea to commercialization. And did that for another almost decade before working with ProMedics. And I have five kids, right? So that is enough to make me morbidly obese and with primary hypertension, because I don't have time for me ever. There is no me. There's everybody else. But, yeah. Anyway, so I've given you broad brushstrokes. I think. Yeah.
Love it. Five kids. What's the age range?
Well, that's the interesting part. So speaking of mathematics, this is revealing on a podcast. My wife and I, our fertility was inverse log. So the older we got, the more fertile we seemed to get. So the first is he's 31. And then the next is 22. And then the next is the 18-year-old that's at SLU with the Billikens. Uh-huh. Go Billikens. And then the next one is 16, and the youngest is 13. So I have an eighth grader, a sophomore, a college student, two college students actually, and an adult as the cohort, as the Filer cohort.
You got the spread. I like it.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
All right. All right, we'll brand that. I love the scientist to business. I want to kind of pick on that here coming up. But let's before we dive into, kind of because going from scientist to operating a business is there's a lot of lessons there that I think a lot of entrepreneurs listening in can learn from. I want to talk more about ProMedics. So monitoring peripheral blood flow. Okay. I guess let's start there. What was the problem? And then, obviously you must've fell in love with the problem at some point in time, right? And said, wow, this is a huge issue. So walk me through why is it a problem? And then kind of the evolution of where, bringing us up to date to where ProMedics is today.
Sure. So the problem is, there are nearly 1.7 million patients, according to the CDC, nearly 1.7 million sepsis cases in the United States. Of that 1.7 million, over a quarter million people will pass away from sepsis. And also, it's extremely expensive. So you can, GE conducted a economics of sepsis study back in, I want to say, like 2017, 2018. They found actually that and it was a consistent finding, was that nearly every single hospital in the United States lost between, you know, 5 and 15 million per year due to sepsis. And part of that is because of a lack of rapid diagnostics. And a lack of rapid diagnostics translates into sicker patients, which receive much more expensive modalities for care. But also, it means reimbursements, CMS reimbursements are less because hospitals have a tremendous challenge in front of them following what are referred to as, you know, SEP 1, SEP 2, SEP 3 bundle protocols for reimbursement through CMS. So hospitals lose a lot of money, and patients experience a tremendous amount of morbidity and mortality. My godfather, my uncle, actually died of sepsis. And so this was something true to my heart that I wished there had been a much more efficacious way of identifying it sooner. New England Journal of Medicine finds that for every hour that a patient goes undiagnosed with sepsis, there's a corresponding 5% greater likelihood, or 12% actually, that they will pass away. So that sicker patient, and you have hospitals, health systems, hospitals, struggling to find ways to accommodate and accelerate the identification of sepsis in patients. In walks two really, really, really brilliant emergency room physicians who were pretty fed up with not being able to identify it very quickly at Dornbecker Children's and Oregon Health and Sciences University Medical Center in Portland, Oregon. And they had this epiphany. See, physicians since the time of Hippocrates have pinched fingers to determine whether a patient is becoming developing shock. And as you saw from my pitch, probably, you know, I asked everyone to pinch their finger and look at their nail bed. It's not a gimmick. You do pinch your finger and look at your nail bed, and the speed at which you're able to get it back to pink after you've pinched and blanched it can be an indicator of progressing disease or an indicator of progressing shock. Our bodies are very, very smart. When sepsis or any type of shock begins to occur, our body sequesters blood and pools it in the vital organs and the brain to keep us alive. So therefore, in terms of sepsis, septic shock, one of the very earliest physiological signs that a patient is becoming septic actually is a slowed capillary refill. So that capillary bit at the very tip of the finger. So physicians are doing that all the time. And really, it's a subjective measure that has really poor inter and intra-rater reproducibility. So even on the same patient, a physician won't be able to necessarily tell you exactly how long it took for the fingertip to turn pink again. And so these two physicians, Dr. Hansen and Dr. Sheridan, had this epiphany. Why are we doing this with our eyeball and just making a subjective guess? Why aren't we digitally measuring whether or not it's taking a while? And so, you know, you're going to find, Duane, in life and in the entrepreneurial space, it's usually the simplest and direct applications and solutions where people go, well, why didn't anyone think of that before? Why didn't anyone think of this before? So the device itself is very simple. It's a pressure sensor along with a temperature sensor, because people's blood flow changes with their temperature, and a photodiode, which does reflective light up and into the bed of the finger, the capillary bed and the fingertip. And then it times digitally how long it takes to refill after, say, a 5 newton amount of pressure onto the fingertip. We have a software application that's tethered to it that, through basically a guided system, allows the person using the device to know whether they're applying the requisite amount of pressure, and then provides a reading as well as a waveform.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. So keep going. So where are you at from bringing this product to market? Are you 510K cleared?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Yeah, no, good question. Okay. So, the prototype that we have right now has been used in almost 2000 patient encounters. Yeah. Under IRB. Okay. And we have relationships, clinical research relationships with multiple, academic medical centers. And principally right now, it is utilized in the emergency room setting and to a lesser degree, intensive care, although that's going to expand. The prototype we have right now, while I think we're going to be doing some pretty serious refinements to, we are looking, I'm knocking on wood right now, we're expecting to file for our 510K at the end of this December. So we've had 4 different meetings with the FDA. We've had our Q sub a year ago last November. And so we definitely have our roadmap and glide path to submitting for our FDA clearance with 510K.
Awesome. Okay, so a few other things. I think I just want to highlight this for all the entrepreneurs listening in. You could start to see why Scott won the pitch competition. Obviously, it's because, you know, while he was telling us how he's you know, it was your good looks, right? That's the obvious.
That's such a lie.
But
I think it's because everyone felt bad for me.
But the second reason why you did well, and you can hear this, and we try to walk all the startups we work with through this when we first start engaging with them. When you were describing the problem, you described the problem to the patients, right? Okay, sepsis, we get that's a problem. But the one thing you articulated really well is why a hospital would care about this and why insurance would care about this, mm-hmm. and why clinicians, and why, whether that be a physician, nurse, whatever it is, or... And then a patient, right? We always talk to our startups about the 4 big buckets that you really need to answer. And when you get to hospital and the insurance company, it just can't be that, well, it's a cool product. There has to be an economic story or value behind that. And within that problem, you interweave that economic value each step of the way, which is really important. And it's like, you know, this is just something that it's part of healthcare, and it doesn't matter what kind of healthcare system we go to, whether it's a single payer healthcare system, whether it's the current situation, it really doesn't make a difference. Healthcare is a business, and so you have to address economic value as well. So I love that you did that within your initial description of the problem there. The other thing that I wanted to highlight was the fact that the earlier the better. It's like, so the earlier you get diagnosed, or the earlier someone could say, oh, they're going septic, the more effective the treatment is. This almost reminds me of stroke, right?
That's right.
Stroke is very much, there's a lot of new technologies that come out, but for the most part, it's time to treatment. That's the biggest thing that no one's been able to really solve for yet. I know there's a lot of companies working on that. So I love that you kind of went upstream and said, hey, instead of trying to work on a better treatment, you're going after, well, if we get people diagnosed sooner, are the treatments going to be, do we really need to worry about another treatment? Are the treatments going to be effective as is? So I love that piece of the puzzle. Was that kind of a lot of the strategy there, where when you were looking at the space?
It's absolutely the issue that you just described, that there's a time parameter, But what's really interesting is when they initially, when the founders initially came up with this concept, this solution, what they were actually thinking about, the very first thing they were thinking about actually was dehydration. And in fact, our first patent is all about dehydration. That was issued. So the dehydration was a problem. And then suddenly they started having issues where people that don't fit neatly categorically into the type of clinical profile which identifies them as a sepsis risk, those people tend to be triaged in the emergency room and then sent back into the waiting room of the emergency room until a room is available. And it's those ambiguous patients that you could have caught the peripheral blood flow sooner and admitted them, or at least admitted them to the ED and begun a therapeutic resuscitation, right? Fluids and antibiotics. Instead, that patient waits another hour. And therein lies that challenge of that 15%. But there's a, let's face it, there's a curious ubiquity to the technology that has applicability to other clinical pathologies that are really important. And then really equally critical is the fact and why I think this we're going to be successful in the marketplace is that really it already fits in clinical workflow. Physicians are already pinching fingers and subjectively observing. And I keep hearing, but it's not uncommon for me to hear from either purchasing agents at hospitals while we're looking at our commercialization pathway or from physicians. And they'll go, well, you know, why would I buy your device? I do it with my eyeball all the time. I have two answers. One is now you don't need to have the years of training and hypothetical deductive reasoning skills that a physician has to do the reading. In other words, a nurse or a tech can actually now do the reading and alert the physician. So it doesn't require somebody who's actually fairly expensive to make that assessment. But equally as important is the fact that the minute you've done a baseline, the minute you have a digital reading on someone's fingertip, whatever therapeutic intervention you decide to pursue, you now in real time can monitor whether the therapy has efficacy through serial readings. So you'll actually be able to see a trending for the patient improving, or in hospital parlance, they're decompensating, they're getting worse. That just doesn't exist. So physicians are right. They can continue to pinch fingers on their own. And you know what? I encourage them to do so. However, this fits into that workflow. It allows for non-physician personnel to be able to make those types of readings and then report on them, put them into Epic. And that changes, by the way, the alert protocols for whether a patient's becoming septic through Epic. And then at the same time, now for the very first time in the industry, physicians can monitor whether what they're doing in real time at the bedside is actually having efficacy without having to wait 85 minutes to 2 hours for blood lactate to return to normal.
Yeah, no, fascinating. I think, you know, that I love the idea of having a measurable point to compare to and how important that is for physicians to make decisions. For example, I have a friend who's a diagnostic radiologist, and his biggest complaint generally is when a very sick patient comes in, he gets some type of scan and it's their first scan. He's never looked at any other scan. That is significantly harder.
Yeah, the physician has no idea what was healthy before. What was good before.
Exactly. Right, yeah. Right. And so with yours, I can see that. The other thing that this reminded me of, and it's only because you've got the cohort of five. I only have I got the sisters Mancini, so I got two kiddos. One is almost three here in December. The other is the other is 3 months old. So the the 3 month old, they test now for the kids being tongue tied, and the test for this reminds me of what you just described, where they pinch a finger and then they look at it. They literally stick their finger in the kid's mouth and go, based on pressure or like the suction power, go, tongue tied or no, not tongue tied. And I could tell you the inaccuracies in this because we had four different physicians stick their finger in our daughter's mouth. And two of them were like, oh, she's tongue tied. She needs to get that clipped. And the other two were like, yeah, she's fine.
Yeah, she's doing great.
And she's doing great.
And you're like, right. And so the average is, you know, 50. It's 50. Yeah. It's 61%. She's doing
right,
awesome.
Right.
What's wrong with you people?
And So I get the procedure. I understand why some people might need it. But my whole point in this was like, this is seriously how we're going to measure whether we're going to go in and do a procedure and clip her tongue or not. And so I just, as you are bringing up your piece, I'm looking at this going, this is what I'm saying is there are things that we make clinical decisions off of in our current system that if you actually watched it happen, you would go, I can't believe this is seriously how we just made the decision to do something. And so,
Wayne, it sounds like you and I have another device to invent then.
Tongue clippings.
Well, right, like just to assess the tongue in newborns. Absolutely. Let me know when we get off the podcast. You let me know. We'll get it rolling.
We'll talk about it. Yeah. Awesome. So going for potential clearance here at the end of this year, that's really exciting. 2,000 patients. Awesome. Okay. I want to dive into molecular biologist to entrepreneur, because this is fascinating. You know, I like talking about this a lot because I have a master's in medicinal chemistry, and now to your point earlier, don't use that degree at all. Very little. I mean, unless we're working with a drug delivery system, I'm not talking about small molecule synthetic chemistry. So curious for you going from a molecular biologist. Green Beret to molecular biologist entrepreneur. The Green Beret is fascinating. I love the song. The Green Beret.
Yeah,
song.
Silver wings upon their chest. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Gets you right here.
three out of 100 will pass the test or something like
that. Listen,
this.
I don't know why. Yeah. You don't have to be too impressed. First of all, I jumped out of a lot of planes, and all that means is I hate flying because I got so used to exiting the aircraft and controlling my own descent that I just don't like landing in airplanes as a general rule. but I can tell you for sure, no matter what time of day it was, whether it's 2 o'clock in the morning or whether it was 2 in the afternoon, every jump for me was what would be referred to as a night jump, because I had my eyes closed every time I exited the airplane. I'm terrified of heights. So I did not enjoy. I have a father-in-law who skydives, and and he always tries to pull this sort of macho thing with me. Well, you know, you should skydive if you're really serious. And I said, I'm not really serious. I don't want to. And he tells me, well, you're not really a paratrooper then. I said, well, okay, but when you skydive, you tell me the next time you jump out at 800 feet where you're so low you actually don't need a reserve, and you're carrying your body weight and gear at 2 o'clock in the morning, then I'll consider you a real skydiver. How's that sound, Dad? I was young and stupid. That was my young and stupid phase. I joined when I was 17. So my parents had to sign for me. And,
wow.
Yeah, I got all sorts of stories. Wow. That'd be a different podcast. Yeah. That's a different podcast.
That could be a different podcast. There's one other person we should have on that one. So Jeff Ryan Brandt, which would have been like episode 7 or 8 of our MedTech Money podcast series. And he'll be speaking at our Houston Startup Symposium here in a couple weeks. I'm pretty sure he was in the 82nd Airborne.
Okay. Good for him.
Yes. So he did a lot of those too.
Yeah. Yeah, he did.
Yeah. I think I could be misspeaking, but I know he was in.
Out of Fort Bragg. Spent a lot of time at Fort Bragg. But one of the things it did do that was interesting is I got deployed. I had three different deployments to the former Yugoslav republics. And I had a really unusual job. I was assigned to help assess the capacity of the former Yugoslav republics, certain locations, their hospital abilities to provide laboratory analysis, and then report back on it. What was absolutely fascinating. So I was in Skopje. I remember being in Skopje, Macedonia, during the Yugoslavian conflict. And I was at a hospital in Skopje, a university hospital. And I looked around and there's glass. Everything's glass. Everything's autoclaved. There's no rapid immunoassays. Everything was plated. And I had an epiphany while I was there. I think that's something that we've lost as a skill in the US for sure. Where a true bacteriologist, right? Someone who actually knew how to plate Brucella and understood its behavior. It's kind of like now that we have all these rapid assays I helped create that universe. But I feel like, yeah, okay, so I can look at Yersinia pestis, I can look at plague bacteria, and I can tell you based on single nucleotide polymorphisms likely where that plague came from. But am I any good at plating it on blood agar? Probably I could make do, but do I understand the organism? And to me, it's the difference between knowing the genome of a gazelle and then actually witnessing a gazelle on a savanna and how it interacts with predatory pressures or in low moisture conditions or during rainfall or when it herds or how it mates. I wish that, you know, we do advance and we do some amazing technologies, but we in the lockstep toward progress, we don't necessarily retain a lot of that gut knowledge of the existence of these things and how they interact in their environment. And that was something I witnessed personally as a Green Beret. The last thing you'd expect, you'd think I was going around, you know, carrying a machine gun, but no, I was actually evaluating how I had a really boring job, but it was great. They fed me well.
Yeah.
As you can tell.
Yeah. I love it. So molecular biologist to entrepreneur, yep. Scott, what were some of the biggest adjustments that you had to make as you went, kind of from that scientist role to, okay, now you're strategically leading a company responsible for mission, vision, culture, values, all of that.
Yeah, right. So first of all, when this progressing to working at a national laboratory, a federally subsidized lab, there's something you learn right away. In fact, I had a really great mentor there, a guy named Tony Policastro, Dr. Tony Policastro. Tony had a really interesting outlook on life. But he graduated with his PhD when he was like 18 from Columbia. So, I mean, this is obnoxiously smart guy. But Tony had this perspective and he said, ideas are cheap and execution is expensive. And so that has stuck with me, this idea that everyone's got an idea, but if you've got no way to commercialize it, it doesn't necessarily improve from a strategy standpoint the market, then it's sort of it's just a neat idea. And in fact, in the national lab system, I don't want to besmirch where I cut my teeth, right, for a decade, but the reality was a lot of people had bright ideas, Dwayne, but these bright ideas, they were It was called advocate research. We were always trying to avoid advocate research, which meant, hey, I've got a great answer that I'm looking for a question to fit, right? And that happens in the structural biology space. That happens. You were to some degree in pharma. It sort of happens. I think because of that, and then having the opportunity to work with tech transfer, really brought home the importance of things that you can readily apply to a strategic business model that makes sense and that you can make money. If you can't answer the question how you make money with something, then you probably shouldn't be chasing that rabbit. But transitioning the business. So I was in healthcare. We were providing nutrition therapy for patients with clinical depression at a facility that my very first job as a CEO. And that's why I went to business school, because I realized, yeah, I can basically understand a P&L. I can basically understand a balance sheet. And I know how to sort of onboard somebody. But to your question about culture and to your question about being able to look at that P&L and balance sheet and start predicting where the stress points are and where you're going to start to lose is a really important skill. And where a lot of people just get that naturally working, scientists generally don't. Did I know how to deal with a grant, you know, a multi-million dollar grant? Sure. And I knew how to set up a budget, but there was no way to understand how to utilize the data in any meaningful way. So it's also made me a better investor, right? Because, you know, you start doing, you know, debt to equity ratio it was certainly a useful exercise for me. I don't know if it is for everybody. I'm sure there's a book that you could buy as a scientist and study on your own and be good at it. But really practically, and not everyone has had the benefit of my life, which was I was in special forces, and special forces is totally different than most military experiences. There's very few officers. You have lots of NCOs. And the job of the officer is to show up and present an audacious goal. And then all the NCOs, you're all considered experts in your field. And so that officer, if you pictured that officer being the chief executive, setting an audacious goal and then providing basically the underpinnings for those NCOs, those professionals, actually to determine the correct path to achieve that audacious goal, and then reflect back to that executive, what are the resources that are needed? It's a collaboration as opposed to, well, I'm the boss and this is what I want us to do. That's great. That's not a really good way to manage people. So in terms of your culture question, I would say the culture that I try to cultivate all the time is one of collaboration, because, and it's also my career that I've chosen, which is to be surrounded by, luckily, people way, way, way smarter than me. And I just, you know, they say a good chief executive is like an orchestra conductor. But you and I both know in the startup space, no, it's more like a jazz ensemble. You're conducting a jazz ensemble. So,
yeah.
So you surround yourself with really, really brilliant people, and you figure out a way to herd them like bees toward your audacious goal, and then provide those underpinnings and resources to make it happen.
Yeah.
And by the way, then it's a completely different conversation about raising capital, because that's all you really do on the startup space. So it's mm-hmm. It's like Rick Ross. Every day I'm hustling. For real. Every day.
I hear you. You know, that's a great segue. So for entrepreneurs listening in who haven't raised money yet, what is your best piece of advice? Was Prometix the first company you raised money for?
No.
Okay.
But I've done more fundraising for this company than I've done others.
But you, so you fundraiser for other companies too. So what's your best piece of advice for startups who have never raised capital that are gearing up to raise for it? And you give yours and then I'll give mine.
Okay. Well, first of all, there's a big difference now in the capital market, and in terms of investment vehicles, there's a big difference now than there was when I first started doing it. It used to be that there was plenty of cash for entrepreneurs, and as long as you were reasonably articulate and you had a decent business model, you could raise capital. The capital markets remain very, very tight. So, first of all, when you're raising money, it will take a lot longer than you think it will. So be prepared emotionally and intellectually for a long haul. And we're talking about raising small amounts. We're not talking about $1 million or $15 million equity rounds, but I'm talking about like angel investment, seed, pre-seed. It's going to still take you longer. The best way to get sort of in front of a lot of these investors is to find an accelerator or an incubator that has a direct link to the market in which your technology applies. So if you're a healthcare IT, if you're a hit company startup, find an accelerator or an incubator that supports that, and be prepared to have to give away a little bit of your ownership in order to have a little bit of capital from them, and then a gateway of introductions, warm introductions to investors, so that you can be in front of them and pitching. Like I said, capital is hard to come by. You are, unfortunately, when you're seed and pre-seed, you are a bit at the mercy of that market. But to only take money that makes sense for your business plan to take. Oftentimes a lot of these early stage investors try to put all sorts of conditions on their capital. Really think hard about the long-term impacts. If someone's giving you a safe for $250,000 and you're like, wow, that's great. But they're putting, you know, right of first refusal and, most favored nation, and that will come back to haunt you later when you try to get investors. In terms of the quality of the investment, and then how readily you can capture the dollars. Boy, I feel like I'm filibustering you though. Did I cover enough of what you thought?
You covered a ton. I mean, this is why we have. We have two different podcast series in relation to this. So we have Project MedTech, we have MedTech Money, which was hosted by Giovanni Loricella, but produced by Project MedTech. And we have 128 episodes of that series, or 127 episodes of that. And that gives you investor, but also it also gives you entrepreneur side of raising capital. We have a new series called Funding MedTech that is kind of like, you know, 20 to 30 minutes. And we're just interviewing funding vehicles for MedTech, whether it be dilutive or non-dilutive.
Well, let me qualify one thing. So this past year, we've raised right around $300,000 in investment, mainly as safes and a little bit as convertibles. We've also acquired a little over $300,000 in non-dilutive grants.
Wonderful.
So that also STTRs, SBIRs are great, but again, you know, you file that application, man, oh man, it's going to take about a year. So don't think that's going to turn around capital on you. It took us a full year for our NSF STTR. But the nice thing about, NSF and NIH, funds is that, especially NSF funds for us, is this idea that once you have a phase one, that does two things. One, it validates potentially your technology and your business applicability. And two, really importantly, it gives you the gateway of filing for a phase two, which is a much larger award. So it's definitely, if you've got the time and you know how to write grants and you're willing to go through the emotional drain, the soul sucking drain of applying for an STTR or an SBIR, it's absolutely worth it on the med tech side.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think, you know, for me, the advice we always start with is one, understand the landscape, and however long you think it's going to take you, probably double it. And the other big piece is to do like a investment strategy readiness assessment. If you are to seriously get into due diligence with somebody, do you truly have everything you need to convince them to write a check into you, and also develop a strategy of who you want to reach out to and why? You can't just go into this aimlessly, because it's just, you're going to waste a lot of time. And you know, as much as people are like, oh, it's, you have to just get as many shots as you can. Yes, but shots on goal.
Yeah, shots on goal, not just random thing. Puck hits. You're absolutely right. Yeah. There are so many angels that have no experience in healthcare. Correct. And you spend an inordinate amount of time explaining your product to someone who has no idea why it should exist. When you're in front of angels where it's like a group of healthcare providers who are the angels, 2 minutes in, they're like, all right, yo, I totally get it. So right. You're absolutely right. You should be a little bit choosy. It is good to pitch as often as possible, because the smoother that elevator gets, the more natural it is. But you're absolutely right. Shots on goal. Identify precisely what market you are in and what type of technology you have, and then go like a maniac toward all those people. And by the way, it is totally worth opening up and having continued dialogue with future investors, sending them updates, keeping in front of them. We expect we're going to have a large equity round sometime next year once we have the 510K, because we're going to be pivoting to manufacturing and selling. So that's a lot of money. We've been in communication with the VCs that we've targeted since last year. So we're sending them consistent updates. They know who we are. We're a known quantity. So when we're ready to start talking business, we're not cold calling anyone. This is a relationship they already have.
Well, and Scott, if you think about that, right, the if you're planning strategically for the future, which as a CEO, you're in charge of that vision and where you're going, you know, we always tell people this is a great chance to let them start keeping a report card on you. And the best part is you're literally setting your grading scale.
Right. You're setting the milestones.
You're setting the milestones.
And, right. We're like, oh, yeah.
It's great.
We bought rubber bands from.
Yeah.
You know,
and we did it.
But yeah. Check. Well, right. Yeah. That was a milestone for me this week from getting our DigiKey. Shout out to DigiKey. We love you guys. For our PCB. So yeah, absolutely.
Love it. Awesome, Scott. So we will have a Prometics website in the show notes. We'll have a link to Scott's LinkedIn page as well. And so depending on the platform you're listening into, up or down an inch, and you'll see a direct link there. Scott, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks for sharing so much information. Super helpful. Good luck in the future. And thanks again for doing this.
Do you want to do another? Should we, the minute the 510K comes in, should we do like a cameo or a
100%. Let's do an update. Yeah, we'll do an update.
I'll have pictures of me for that one. As a Dream Ray, I'd show you and you'd be like, man, that dude's fat.
All right, Scott, hang on for one more minute. We'll chat offline. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you need anything from the podcast, you can always contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.